Chapter 15. Sloane wore sunglasses, though the sky was dark with clouds, and made her way through the crowd. Lakeshore Drive had been a parking lot. She had given up near the Michigan Avenue exit, pulling her car over to the shoulder and leaving it there. Sweat dotted her hairline, and she was breathless from half walking, half jogging all the way downtown. But she had made it to the monument site, or at least to the security barrier that the police had set up there. She walked up to the nearest police officer and took off her sunglasses. The woman gave her an odd look, but nodded and gestured for her to go through. "Thanks," Sloane mumbled. And she put her sunglasses back on, stepped around the barrier, and speed walked away before anyone in the crowd behind her figured out why she had been let through. She spotted Esther ahead, dressed in a long black coat that just brushed the pointed toes of her patent leather boots. Esther raised a perfectly penciled eyebrow at her. "Where the hell have you been?" Esther demanded. Then she wrapped Sloane in a hug. "Matt said you freaked out."
"I guess that's one way of describing it," Sloane said. "How did word get out?"
"Don't give me that look," Esther said. "I haven't been on social media since yesterday." Sloane snorted. "It was Matt," Esther said. "He contacted the police to let them know we'd be doing this today, just in case anything weird happened. One of them probably has a big mouth." She should have known it was Matt's fault. He had never understood why she wanted to stay so private. He didn't mind sliding his name into dinner reservations to get a better table, or winking at people who gave him a second look on the sidewalk. "We have to pay the price of this life all the time," he had said to her once. "Might as well get something good out of it when we can." She spotted him standing next to the monument. When he saw her, it was like a big knot unraveling. He grabbed at her, as if testing to see that she was real, and then held her for a few seconds, his breath shaking in her ear. He had thought she was dead, Sloane realized. Her sunglasses crushed against his shoulder. Somehow it hadn't occurred to her to reassure him. "I'm sorry," she said. But she wasn't sure what for. For leaving. For the fight they'd had before Albie died. For destroying the dome. Or for what she would have to do next. Fleeing Eris, maybe leaving the country. "Yeah," he replied, avoiding her eyes. It meant he didn't forgive her, and that was what she had expected. Even Matt had limits to his mercy. His eyes were red. He had been crying. Maybe awake all night. Inez stalked over to them and punched Sloane in the arm, hard enough to make her wince.
"God, Sloane," Inez snapped. "You're such an asshole."
"Yeah," Sloane said, breathless. "Can you give me just a second? You can yell at me when I get back." She slipped past Inez and walked toward the edge of the monument site, where the concrete dropped off to the river. She pressed her stomach into the railing. The mildew and mud smell of the river overpowered the smoky scent that clung to her hair. She put her hand in her pocket and felt for the pieces of the needle. They numbed her fingertips on contact. She put her elbows on the railing, leaning out as if to get a better look at the bridge where she had lured the Dark One to his death. She tipped her hand, and the needle pieces fell into the water. She looked down just in time to see the metal glinting as the pieces fell to the river bottom. She didn't need to see their resting place to know where they were. Even broken, the needle hummed at the same frequency as she did. She would always be able to find it again. Sloane returned to the others and found Inez scowling at her.
"Just needed to look again," she said.
They hadn't found the Dark One's body. 10 years later, they had all accepted that it lay buried under the concrete, steel, and glass from the old tower. Packed into the river bottom too densely for anything to be retrieved.
but initially they had all been afraid that he wasn't really gone. Sloane had even joined the divers who searched the debris for any trace of him, not satisfied until she found a few things. A gold button that looked like it came from his coat. A rotten shred of fabric that resembled his shirt cuff. Even after that, she had come back every few weeks to remind herself that the river was his grave, that he was really dead. Inez had gone with her. Sloane spotted a familiar figure in the doorway of the monument. A girl with crooked features and light brown hair, so fine and frizzy, it hovered around her face like spun sugar. Albie's little sister, Caitlin. It hurt to look at her. Sloane took off her sunglasses. Caitlin gave her a little smile. Albie's mom, Mrs. Summers, was the only name Sloane knew her by, appeared behind her, clutching a floral handkerchief against her chest. She nodded to Sloane and stepped past her daughter, out of the monument. Mrs. Summers had never liked Sloane, probably for the same reasons that other people didn't. She was the kind of person who followed celebrity gossip religiously and believed what she read in chain emails that warned of new viruses and internet curses. Every time the Sloane of Gossip Rags cheated on Matt, Mrs. Summers was on the phone with Albie, asking if it was true. Today, though, all she said was, "Thank you for taking care of the..." Mrs. Summers' eyes filled with tears, thinking of the cremation, no doubt. Sure. I mean, of course. Sloane shook her head. She didn't know what to say. Luckily, Esther was there to help. "Hey, Mrs. Summers," she said. "My mom sent this with me." She offered Mrs. Summers an envelope with elegant cursive writing on it. Mrs. Summers turned away from Sloane, looking relieved. Next to Sloane, Matt was frowning at his phone. "I just got a news alert," he said. "Something happened at the dome." He looked up at Sloane. She stared back steadily. If he asked her, she decided, she wouldn't lie. She was done with that. Maybe it was her fault that Matt thought she was better than she was. She had spent so much time pretending for his sake. Maybe it was time he knew what he was really dealing with. Heat rushed into her face, and she was ready. Ready for him to ask. Ready to tell him. "Well," Inez said, "shall we?" She was holding the little can the crematory had given Sloane. A heavy silence fell. Before the last stand, as it were, we all talked about what we wanted if we died, Inez said. She sniffed. Albie said he didn't want a big thing, just for his ashes to be scattered somewhere the Dark One had hit with the drain. He felt like, I don't know, he felt connected to the people who died in the same fight. It was a comfort for him, in a way, knowing that if he died, he wouldn't be alone. Sloane stepped to the side so they were all in a circle. Caitlin and Mrs. Summers, Matt and Esther, Inez and her. Inez opened the lid of the canister. Inside it were the gray ashes, and on top of them something yellow and bright. A paper crane. Mrs. Summers spotted it first and started to laugh. They all laughed then, not because it was funny, but because it wasn't. Because laughter was a full-body hiccup. Wild and strange. And death was wild and strange, too. "I can't believe he's gone," Sloane said when silence fell again. Caitlin took the canister from Inez and turned west, away from Lake Michigan. She tossed the ashes in a wide arc toward the monument. The yellow crane tumbled to the ground. A hand in a houndstooth patterned mitten wrapped around Sloane's. Esther. and on her other side, a sturdy leather glove. Matt. All four of them were clasped together, with a few of the ashes dancing around their feet. Sloane's vision went blurry with tears. And then she heard a gentle voice. It seemed to speak right into her ear. Too quiet at first for the words to be intelligible. She felt the tingle and burn that she associated with the needle and with magic, and looked around her. The others had their heads bowed, and they weren't moving. Esther's and Matt's hands still held hers, the pressure steady. "Sloane," the voice said. And it was Albie's. She searched for him, scanning the monument, the river, the crowd beyond the barrier. But she couldn't see him. She felt something tugging at the back of her hand where the scar from the needle was. "Let's go," Albie's voice said, from in front of her now, a whisper against her cheek. It was stupid to think he might be there, even in some small way, just because his ashes were here. Just because this was a place where they had done powerful magic. But she had seen and felt and done impossible things, ripped doors free of their hinges and sent them sailing toward the clouds, watched trees hover over the ocean, burst a skyscraper like a grape. She had opened herself to wanting things that could never be hers, and she had gotten them. What was so different about this? The Dark One had died here. Maybe Albie could be alive somewhere else. She took one step toward the voice, and then regretted it. Tried to step back, to go back. But it was too late. Everything had gone dark. Part 2.
Excerpt from It's a Magical World Out There, An Elementary Schooler's Guide to Magic, 7th edition, by Agnes Dewey and Sebastian Bartlett. Did you know that the world used to be a whole lot less magical? Well, it's true. Up until 1969, most people didn't think magic really existed. It was just fairy tale stuff. But in 1969, something called the Tenebris Incident, more on that in Chapter 3, happened, and magic spread all over Genetrix. People all across our planet saw some amazing but scary things, like certain parts of the ocean boiling for no reason, Figure 2. Glowing balls of light floating around neighborhoods, Figure 3. And whole buildings turning upside down, Figure 4. One person even took a picture of a whale floating in the clouds, Figure 5. After magic spread, a lot of people also got really sick. Their bodies weren't used to the magical energy in the air. And since there was no cure for the magical plague, those people all died, which was really sad. But if you're here, that means that you're immune to the magical plague, so you don't need to worry about it. All you need to know is that magic is part of our world now, and it's time for you to learn how to use it. You won't be able to do very much until you're older, but even what you can do now is pretty cool. First, though, you have to learn how magic works. The truth is, we don't even really know how magic works. We're only just starting to understand it. Isn't that exciting? Maybe one day, you'll be the person who discovers all of magic's secrets.
Excerpt from The Manifestation of Impossible Wants, A New Theory of Magic by Arthur Solowell. In the burgeoning field of magical theory, we often speak of intent being a central component of the magical arts. A siphon, for example, cannot function without a person to wield it and direct its power. It is fundamentally inert, no more than a blunt instrument without the living form to fill it. And certainly, intent is important. How else would a person be able to control the results of a siphon's work? How else would someone be able to, say, reliably freeze an object rather than set it on fire? Certain types of siphons are indeed attuned to particular tasks. An eye siphon is most often used for visual workings, an ear siphon for auditory ones, etc. But each offers a great deal of flexibility, even within those categories. Intent, then, ensures that flexibility does not mean unreliability. However, I would argue that while intent is a component of a magical act, and certainly a significant one, it is not the essence of what distinguishes a magical act from a mundane one. Any man with a hammer can intend to hit a nail. That itself is not magic, and a siphon is no hammer. Instead, it is the argument of this text that the essence of a magical act is what a person wants. Or to be more specific, what a person wants that is not easily achieved within the realm of the mundane. Desiring that a nail sink into a board is a want, but it is not magic. Wanting the boards to hold together with no nail at all, that is magic. In other words, for something to be magic, it must be an impossible want.
Excerpt from Senator Amos Redding's speech in support of the Haven Act, September 17, 1985. I take the Senate floor today to share my thoughts on a most contentious issue, that of the proposed Haven Act, which, if passed, would enable the citizens of a city to vote to prohibit the use of magic, as well as the establishment of businesses that sell devices that make use of magic or otherwise facilitate its use. I intend today to vote yes on the Haven Act, and I will tell you why. Ladies and gentlemen, magic is a shortcut. It is the easy path, and we do not know where it leads or what may come of it. It is one thing to be excited by its possibilities, but it is another to allow it to spread uncontrollably through our nation, rendering our young people unable to perform the slightest practical task, leaving no space clear of its influence. We must maintain the skills we have fought so hard over so many years of human history to learn. We must honor the past as we look toward the future. I ask you, colleagues and friends, to consider the future you would like to have, and the future you would like this country to have. Magic has long been regarded with suspicion, going all the way back to our earliest myths and legends. This distrust, and even loathing for the practice of magic, is not merely due to ignorance. It speaks to something at the very core of us, something that says we should be working the land we live in, that great accomplishments should be hard won by the labor of our hands.
Chapter 16. She remembered, right after the building blew apart, right after the needle had sent light into the sky, right before the dark one disappeared, the taste of river water and the pale glint of his cheek in the moonlight. Sloane tried to scream and choked on water instead. Esther's hand slackened in hers, then slipped free. Matt's soon followed. Sloane waved her arms wildly, trying to find either of them again. But her movements were slow, and the darkness around her was absolute. She coughed silent bubbles. Water. She was surrounded by water. Her lungs burned. She kicked. She was moving, but she didn't know where she was going. For all she knew, she was swimming deeper. She put a finger up to her lips and blew a bubble. It tickled the underside of her fingertip, which meant she was upright. Bubbles always moved up, toward the surface. She kicked harder. Her coat, soaked through, dragged behind her, and she wriggled free of it. Then pulled the strap of her bag over her head so it crossed her chest. She opened her eyes, ignoring the sting of the water in search of light. Nothing. There was nothing. With both hands empty, it was easier to swim. Cameron had taught her to swim when they were children, at the park district pool. One summer, they had gone there every day. They had competed against each other for the biggest splash, cannonballing into the deep end. She pulled herself up and up
and up. Ahead of her was a glimmer of light, just a hint at first, and then a circle of bright teal, blurry. She swam toward it. One of her shoes fell off. She kicked harder, legs, arms, and chest burning. She broke through the surface with a gasp. She tilted back to float, her heartbeat sounding in her ears. Above her was a waning crescent moon, thin as a toenail clipping, surrounded by a sky purple with light pollution. She could have sworn the moon had been waxing when she was walking toward the dome with needle in hand. It was as if almost a month had passed in a single breath. She slapped a hand over her eyes and rubbed them to clear them. Not to mention the fact that Albie's funeral had been in the morning. She knew where she was. The smell of river water rotten in her nostrils was familiar, as was the irregular outline of the corncob building in the distance, partly obscured by the strict lines of 330 North Wabash. But in place of the monument to the Dark One's defeat was a tower. Not Trump Tower, gleaming blue and scratching the sky with its needle, but a building unlike anything she'd seen before. Half straightforward glass cylinder, half undulating steel panels, like a breath of smoke spilling down the western side. No longer desperate for air, Sloane straightened up and noticed, for the first time, a line of people standing on the shore. In the light cast by the old-fashioned globular fixtures along the riverwalk, she saw clothes in dark, rich colors and heavy fabrics, artfully draped. Sloane kicked to keep herself afloat as she pushed her hair away from her face. Every muscle in her body ached, but she wasn't sure she wanted to move closer to the edge, closer to them. "Who?" she spat, her voice coming out rough and guttural. It carried across the water and echoed off the concrete walls on either side of the river that held the streets back from the water. "Who are you?" A woman, dark, thick hair, light brown skin, dressed in green, stepped forward and seemed to be about to speak when Esther burst through the surface of the water, mascara streaking down her face. Matt followed, his head emerging right at the edge of the river. He grabbed the barrier to steady himself as he vomited water at the woman's feet. She hopped back. Her shoes were shiny and came to a point. "What?" The woman turned to someone else, a blonde man standing away from the river's edge, cradling a thick book against his chest. "Why are there more than one?" "I don't." The man was gaping at Sloane, Esther, and Matt in turn. "I don't know." "Where's Inez?" Sloane asked Esther and Matt. Esther shook her head. "I didn't see her." Sloane gave up on treading water, swam to the edge, and hoisted herself up, her arms trembling under her weight. She fell, almost cracking her head on the sidewalk, but got her knees under her and stood. She was taller than the woman, but not by much. The woman stepped back. "I asked you a question," Sloane said. Unfortunately, some of the menacing effect was lost because she had to bend over to cough up more water. It tasted like moldy peach. "Calm down, please," the woman said. "We..." "The fuck she will," Esther said from the water. She was fighting to free herself of her coat. Sloane saw the white trails of her breath in the moonlight. Matt had managed to haul himself over the side and sat with water leaking from his pants legs. Esther made it to the edge and pushed her hair away from her face. Sloane scanned the line of people now just a few feet away from her. Their styles of dress were varied, but they had one thing in common. A gold pin about the size of a mandarin orange, fastened to their chests. Several of them also wore elaborate jewelry, somewhat mechanical in style, around their throats or on their hands. One woman had a piece covering her left ear, red-plated, like it was made of rubies. "Where are we?" Matt asked them in the low voice he used when he meant business. He thought it was intimidating, but to the rest of them it just sounded like a Batman impression. They had all agreed not to tease him about it, since he seemed to enjoy it. "Which of you is the chosen one?" the woman said, scanning each of them in turn. They made a dignified bunch, Sloane thought. Esther was on the edge of the river now, rubbing her hands over her face to get rid of the mascara streaks. Matt was yanking off one of his soaked leather gloves with his teeth. And Sloane's pants were so heavy with water, she was sure her ass was showing. "You don't get to ask questions until you answer some," Sloane said, pulling her pants up by the belt loops. Matt raised his hand. "Me. I'm the chosen one." Esther snorted. "What?" Matt shrugged. She asked a simple question. "I mean, we were sort of all the chosen one," Esther clarified. She had managed to smear the mascara tracks sideways toward her ears. Sloane realized that she hadn't seen Esther without a thick layer of makeup on since the last battle. She looked tired. As tired as Sloane felt. "One of us is missing," Sloane said. "Where's Inez?" The woman frowned at her. "We were expecting one of you, not three, and certainly not four. And to answer your previous question, you are in the exact same place you were a moment ago, with the notable difference that you are now one dimension to the left, so to speak." "Like an alternate universe?" Esther said. "Are you high?" A long time ago, Sloane had learned about parallel dimensions, about string theory and infinite possibilities branching off from one another into an eternity no human being could comprehend. Ever since, she had avoided thinking about it, not wanting to consider that for every decision she made, there was an identical Sloane on another Earth making the other decision. The universe is branching off forever. Who was she, really, if there was no stability in her identity? If there were that many Sloanes walking that many paths, nudged this way and that by minor alterations in circumstance? "Who are you?" Sloane said again. In any universe, in any dimension, her first concern was always people. "My name is Aelia," the woman said. "I am Praetor of Cordis and Tribune of the Army of Flickering." "Did she just say words?" Esther asked Sloane. "Did you just say words, lady?" They were old words, and strange ones, with the lights of a modern city glittering behind the woman's head. But Sloane caught the meaning of them. "She's Aelia, and she's in charge," she translated. "Another dimension," Matt said. "How is that possible?" "Your people are not aware of other dimensions?" Aelia said, frowning. She wore stiff fabric draped around her shoulders, narrow trousers tapered at the ankle, and a shirt with a short, upright collar. Style Sloane recognized, but also didn't. The gold pin on her chest stood out against the gray and green of her clothes. And she wore an apparatus on her hand that looked like a mechanical, bejeweled glove. "In the abstract only," Matt replied. Aelia looked again at the blonde man, scorn in the scrunch of her nose. "Then this must be quite a shock," Aelia said. Sloane snorted. "I know you have questions, and I promise to answer them," Aelia said, narrowing her eyes at Sloane. "But in order for me to do that, you will have to trust us enough to come with us somewhere." Matt twisted the hem of his coat in both hands to squeeze out some of the water. He had the casual air of someone shaking out an umbrella after coming in from the rain. "Okay," he said. "No!" Sloane glared at him. Her pants were slipping down her hips again. "We're not about to just go somewhere else. Not until we know what the hell is going on." Matt's lips quirked at the corner. For a few years, while they hunted the Dark One, that was the only smile he had ever worn. But after the Dark One fell, she had seen it less and less often as he softened and relaxed, no longer responsible for any life but his own. The return of that smile meant he was working Aelia, and Sloane was getting in the way. "You must let them play to their strengths as they let you play to yours," Bert's voice told her from her memories. They each had a place in their small platoon, and though it grated on her now that she and Matt were engaged, Matt was the leader. He made the calls. They had to trust him or the system would break. "I intend to tell you," Aelia said, "but some things are better explained by seeing them for yourself." Esther, coming to stand beside Sloane, looked just as wary as Sloane felt. But she caught Sloane's eye and nodded, lips pursed. "Fine, show us," Sloane said. Sloane stayed in Aelia's shadow as they climbed the wide steps of what was, on Sloane's earth, the River Theater, a wide, minimalist staircase made of polished stone. Here, however, the space was arranged into terraces, like steps, but with trees growing from each flat area, giving the impression of a forest right in the middle of the city. Aelia wove around the trees, and Sloane, Matt, and Esther followed her up to street level. The other observers fell into step behind them. Their silence unsettled Sloane, their presence behind her pricking at the back of her neck. She felt like she was being herded. She was almost afraid to lift her head, to be confronted with the wrongness of the place. But Wacker Drive, at least, was the same street she remembered, with cars careening around the bend ahead of them, and there was the 17th Church of Christ Scientist, which looked like a grounded spaceship, standing where the two branches of Wacker separated. There were no pedestrians on the sidewalks, and it wasn't until the group of people behind her fanned out that she realized why. One of them lifted his hand and let out an inhuman trill. A wall of iridescence appeared in front of him, forming a barrier across the walkway 100 yards from where Sloane stood. Aelia cleared her throat. She stood beside a boxy, wine-colored limousine with chrome wheels. Aelia opened the wide back door, then pulled the center panel open from the left so she could slide inside. The blonde man waited beside the car. He raised a hand, and with the sleeve falling away from his wrist, Sloane got a closer look at the apparatus he wore. It was simpler than the one Aelia had, but no less beautiful. It looked like a glove, but it was made of copper, with articulated joints. Dense, organic patterns, vines of tiny leaves, were carved into each plate, and unlike a bulky gauntlet from an old set of armor, it was streamlined, clearly made to fit him and him alone. "I can dry you off, if you like," he said. Sloane glanced at Esther. "We would not have brought you here simply to harm you a moment later," he said. "My name is Nero. Who wants to go first?" It took a few seconds for Matt to volunteer, though he had been the one insisting that they go along with this. He stood in front of Nero, fidgeting a little. "What do I do?" he said. "Stay still, please," Nero replied. He held his hand up, fingers spread, palm facing Matt. He hummed a low note, and Matt's shirt shifted, almost imperceptibly, as if hit by a breeze. Nero hummed again, and droplets of water pulled away from Matt's head and dangled in the air. He stared at them, dazed. Sloane looked around, just to make sure time hadn't frozen and kept the water from falling. It would not have been the strangest thing to happen that day. Nero hummed the same steady note as he moved his hand down to hover over Matt's shoulders, abdomen, and then pelvis. Water tugged free from the fabric of his coat and shirt and hung suspended in the air. When Nero finished, he hummed a different note, moving his hand in a circle. All the droplets that had been hanging in mid-air around Matt's body flew toward him and coalesced into a sphere of water. He ushered the ball of water forward so it hovered over the street, then dropped it into the gutter with a gesture. Once it hit the ground, it collapsed, becoming shapeless liquid again. Sloane had seen magic before, a force like a hurricane that tore people apart from every direction. An unstable leap of flames in Albie's hands. Even the strange light that had emanated from Matt's golden bow. But she had never seen it manipulated with such delicacy, such magnificent precision. Matt was dry now, his shirt crisp. Nero turned to Esther and Sloane. Who's next? Matt, Esther, and Sloane crammed into the back seat of the limousine. Sloane pinched the burgundy velour between her thumb and index finger and looked out the window. They were driving around the bend of Upper Wacker toward Lakeshore Drive. Moonlight rippled on the lake. The jagged skyline was mostly unfamiliar, but with some touchstones Sloane recognized. The vertical white lines of the Aeon Center. The glass slant of the Crane Communications Building, like a carrot cut on the bias. The ionic columns of the Field Museum. What are those things? Matt said, pointing at the apparatus on Nero's hand and then Aelia's. Aelia's hand rested on her kneecap, so Sloane could see in better detail the thick cuff wrapped around her wrist, with delicate chains attached to it that followed the lines of her fingers, finishing in a thimble-like cap at the end of each fingertip. Red beads were scattered along each chain, and a red jewel was set into the middle of the cuff. Aelia held up her hand. These are called siphons, Aelia replied. They channel magical energy. Magic, Matt repeated. But they look like tech. Actually, Esther pointed out, they kind of look like jewelry. They are all three, Aelia said, looking puzzled. Magic, technology, and adornment. Are these things at odds where you are from? Our technology doesn't use magic, Matt said. We're some of the only people who ever wielded it, and even we were only just beginning to understand how to manipulate it. And it had killed Albie, Sloane thought bitterly. Aelia turned to Nero and arched an eyebrow at him. Nero ducked his head. Fascinating, Aelia said. Our integration of both elements is not seamless. There are some who insist that technology should advance without magic, in case magic proves to be a finite resource. And there are even some who view the use of magic as the work of the devil. But this is a siphon, a triumph of technology and magic both. She turned her hand over, made a fist, then unfurled her fingers. She whistled and sparks danced in her palm. Originally invented by Lu Huoyen in Xiamen, China, in 1980. Nero chimed in. Magic was not widespread on Genetrix until 1969. Sloane stared at Aelia's hand. The sparks were already gone, but they had left her with a crooked afterimage. What happened in 1969? Matt asked. The Tenebris incident, Nero replied. We'll have time for history lessons later, I'm sure, Aelia said. You call your planet Genetrix? Esther asked. Her hands were in fists on her knees, her knuckles white. Sloane looked out the window again. She knew enough about architecture to understand that some of these buildings didn't fit the usual categories. The modernist structures that had become so ubiquitous as to be unremarkable to her were gone. In their place were strange shapes lit in an array of colors. Before she could comprehend any of them, the limo had already driven past. They exited Lakeshore Drive and plunged into the South Loop. When magic became common, we began using two names for places. One for the mundane, and another to refer to the magical aspects of those locations, Aelia said. We use the names Earth and Genetrix both, just as we refer to this city as both Chicago and Cordis, which means second. Right, the second city, Matt said, rebuilt after the fire. I feel like I'm dreaming, Esther said in a low voice to Sloane. Like the first time I saw footage of the drain. Sloane nodded. They drove past the yellow arches of a McDonald's, unchanged from the one Sloane knew. You weren't holding hands with Inez when we came here, Sloane said. Esther shook her head. I had just let go. I don't remember her being in the water with us. She's probably back on Earth then, Sloane said. Maybe there's a way to contact her. They stopped at a traffic light, and Sloane peered into the car next to theirs. There was a woman behind the wheel, a siphon on her left hand, her right hand twisting the radio knob. The glow from the dashboard was orange, analog instead of digital. There was a clock between the air vents, with hands pointing at 10 and 12. It was 10 o'clock p.m. What can you do with that thing? Esther asked Nero. There was still a smear of mascara on her temple. Siphons can be attached to most parts of the body, and their placement affects what they do, Nero said. Wrist siphons, like this one, tend to be used for the practical, electrical manipulation, as well as water, air, fire? Sloane asked. Nero nodded. So it's a weapon, then, she said. Anything can be a weapon, Nero replied, if you're trying hard enough. I'm just trying to figure out to what extent we're being held hostage, Sloane said. She was surprised that Matt didn't jump in to chastise her for sounding so harsh, but he kept quiet. Maybe he wanted to know the same thing. Nero's mouth twitched into a mild smile. Mild was a good word for him overall, Sloane thought. His voice had a silky quality, not persuasive, but delicate. His movements, from his footsteps to his smallest gestures, were careful, as though he were consciously selecting each one. He turned his hand over and unfastened a clasp on the underside of the siphon glove. A light flickered between the metal plates as he undid it. He slid it off his hand, set it on the floor of the limousine between them, and showed her his palms. We do not intend to threaten you, Nero said. And who is we? Matt said. You and her? The group that summoned you is the Special Council of Cordis, Aelia said. We were assembled to address a particular problem that I will describe to you in full. I am the leader of that council, as well as an elected official in city government. Praetor, as I said. Sloane frowned at the device on the floor. She didn't feel the burning, tingling pull of magic here the way she did at home. She stretched out a hand toward the siphon, waiting for something. Anything. But she felt nothing. Maybe here, magic suffused the world so completely that she couldn't feel it. The way a person stops hearing white noise after a few minutes. She brushed her fingers over the siphon, and it felt warm from skin contact, but otherwise inert. It requires intent, Nero said to her. That was what she was afraid of. The car stopped. Aelia opened the door and gestured for them to follow her. On their side of the street were old-fashioned gas lamps with elegant black bases and glass spotted brown from the flames. On the other side of the street was rubble. broken chunks of concrete piled up against cracked wood beams, which were fraying where they had split right down the middle. Twisted girders reached upward. Broken glass shone in the moonlight. Sloane heard Esther's footsteps behind her, then felt her cool, dry hand. Sloane grabbed it, held it tight, and both women stood shoulder to shoulder, staring. One building's remains tumbled into another's, and on, as far as Sloane could discern in moonlight alone. Where a street had been was carnage and destruction, a curl of yellow-white, the spine of a squirrel, a woman's blouse patterned with flowers, trapped under a rock, a bit of stuffing from a plush toy in the mouth of a scurrying rat. "The drain," Esther said. Sloane felt like time had run backward, and she was at the edge of the site where the dome would later stand, surrounded on all sides by worshippers of the Dark One and seekers of magic. The drain was like a fingerprint, distinct from all other forms of magic she had witnessed. And only one person could leave that particular mark. If this was a drain site, then the Dark One had been here. Nero moved away from them to set up the same barriers Sloane had seen on Wacker Drive, intended to keep pedestrians away. But Aelia stayed beside them. "In your world," Aelia said, spreading the fingers encased in her siphon wide so her hand looked like a metal claw, "there was a force of evil at work, one that you defeated?" "The Dark One," Matt replied quietly. "Yes, we, actually, all of us, killed him." "Wonderful," Aelia smiled, and it looked almost sinister in the dim light of the gas lamps. Shadows pooled beneath her prominent cheekbones. "We too have a kind of Dark One. Our name for him is the Resurrectionist." "Is?" Esther said. "Present tense?" "Yes," Aelia said. "Our Resurrectionist is still alive, still terrorizing us, still doing this." She gestured to the dark expanse before them. Sloane saw dark shapes moving ahead, darting in and out of the broken buildings. The area had the trademark pattern of a drain site, the bits of concrete and wood and steel growing smaller the farther in you looked. At the center, everything would be fine as sand. "This happened last year," Aelia said. "The closest the Resurrectionist has ever gotten to our city center. They grow more powerful by the year, and they inch closer." "Is that they singular or plural?" Esther asked. "Did your Dark One work alone?" Aelia's mouth twisted into a wry grin. "There are followers. There are always followers. But the Resurrectionist's followers are where the nickname comes from. They are the Walking Dead." Across from them was the skeleton of a house, stripped of siding and drywall. Insulation tumbled in the wind, pink and puffy as cotton candy. "Like you, we had a chosen one," Aelia said. "He was valiant and a talented worker of magic. Young, too. Too young, perhaps." "He was?" Esther asked. "He is dead," Aelia's voice cracked. "He was defeated." It should have been obvious, Sloane thought, even expected. If there was a universe in which she and her friends had won, of course there were universes where they had lost, where they had died, where they had never even existed. "But he's the chosen one," Esther said. "He can't be dead. Are you sure you got the right one?" "We are certain," Aelia said curtly. "We had a prophecy. It was quite specific. And we used its magical signature to summon you here. Magical signature, Matt said at the same time Esther said. Why did you summon us? Matt stepped back. Hers was the question he really wanted answered, Sloane assumed. Isn't it obvious? Sloane said bitterly, her voice trembling. She wants us to take on her Dark One for her. He isn't my Dark One, Aelia snapped. And I assure you, I would not have resorted to such measures unless the situation was truly dire. I can't allow more people to die. I can't allow more of our world to fall into ruin. Oh, well, if the situation is dire, then it's okay to kidnap people from other dimensions, Sloane said. Her throat felt tight with rising hysteria. Yeah, here I was thinking the direness quotient wasn't high enough, Esther added sourly. I assure you it is, Aelia said, her voice becoming almost shrill. I don't think she's very good at sarcasm, Esther said to Sloane. She's going to love us then, Sloane replied. You have to understand, Matt said, raising his voice a little to talk over them. We've already been through this, and we're not eager to go through it again, especially for a place that doesn't even belong to us. I'm afraid it's not that simple. Nero spoke from a few yards away, in the middle of the street. His fingers twisted together in front of him, metal siphon glove wrapped around flesh. The fates of our worlds are no longer as distinct as one might hope. Matt said. What? Our worlds are connected, Nero said. We can see it, the connection. The use of magic has made both of our worlds unstable. The resurrectionist preys on this instability to accomplish his destruction. Sloane narrowed her eyes. How? We don't know. We don't know anything for certain. All we know is that this, Aelia gestured to the rubble that confronted them, is not something he should be able to do. It's not something anyone was able to do until he came along. Sloane thought about touching the needle for the first time, how it had turned her into an empty stomach, a black hole of wanting, how she had taken everything, everything into herself. Indiscriminate and frantic, churning water into froth and bones into particles of sand. How she had burst through the surface of the ocean, soaked with blood and roaring with power. No, she said. The word came out broken. No, it can't be. This can't be happening. Sloane, Matt said softly. We killed him, Sloane said. I saw him under the water. I saw him die. In one world, Matt said. Apparently not in every world. Well, that was my world. I did my part. I fought my Dark One. I did my job. She was crying. She hated crying. You can stay and help if you want, but I'm not going to do it again. It was hard enough the first time. Matt's hand fell on Sloane's left shoulder, then her right. So she was looking at him. She needed a benzo. She needed a mother who didn't suck. She needed to be home. I can't, she said again, this time only to Matt. I know, Matt said, nodding. Me either, Sloane. Except I think we might have to. Sloane looked over Matt's shoulder at Aelia, asking her a question without asking. It is a huge feat to send or summon between universes, Aelia said. We will only be able to accomplish it once more, to send you home, which our urgent need compels us to do only after we have received your help. So you kidnapped us, Esther said. And now you're holding us prisoner until we help you. Aelia looked down, didn't answer. Just wanted to be sure I was clear on the situation. Esther sounded bitter but tremulous. Sloane looked over Matt's shoulder at the stripe of darkness in front of her, flanked by intact buildings, cheerfully lit. An entire city block obliterated. Aelia had brought them here to gain their sympathy, Sloane was certain. Show them a tangible sign of the destruction they were dealing with. "This is just the beginning," this place said, "of the horrors I will show you. It's a simple choice, my dear," the Dark One had whispered. Sloane tasted bile. "I'm sure you need time to process all of this," Aelia said. "We have prepared rooms for you to stay in while you're here. We can speak again tomorrow after you've rested." Esther reached for Sloane's hand and squeezed it gently. She felt warm and steady and familiar. They had fought side by side before, in situations they thought they would never escape. Sloane remembered the two of them staying up to keep watch, their spines pressed together as they each watched a different horizon. Sloane let the heat of her friend draw her back to herself. She knew how to do this. Knew how to search dark landscapes for enemies. How to fall only half asleep. How to booby-trap a house with a jar of marbles. How to march inexorably toward a single end and a near-certain doom. It was like a dance, and she would never forget the steps.
Excerpt from Life and Death, Scholars on the Resurrectionist and His Army, by Garrett Rogers. From The Possibility of the Impossible, an interview with Marwa Daoud, Professor of Magical Theory, University of Chicago.
Magic has confronted us all with many utter impossibilities made possible. But thus far, it obeys certain rules. A person cannot, for example, make herself fly through the air like a bird or conjure food out of nowhere. Up until the emergence of the Resurrectionist, we believed that bringing the dead to life was another one of those limits. But the Resurrectionist's army is, as I'm sure you know, composed of individuals that appear to be corpses. Yet they walk, talk, and even produce magic themselves on occasion. How can this be? How can this terrorist raise an entire army when the world's most talented magic users cannot reanimate anything larger than a house cat? Is he, assuming the Resurrectionist is a he, that much more powerful than the rest of us?
A house cat. You're referring to the experiment by the German Franz Becker about 5 years ago?
Yes, Becker. He was a brilliant scientist. So tragic that he was able to bring his recently deceased pet cat back to life, only for the act to kill him shortly thereafter. Here's a fine example of what I am saying, which is that other people have indeed tried to raise the dead. Magic is still relatively new, so I am not positing that no one else ever will walk in the Resurrectionist's footsteps. But it seems to be a long way off. That doesn't mean that we can't learn something from this army in the meantime. Quite the contrary. On a theoretical level, his army is significant. Outliers and anomalies are always central to my thinking because they expand our understanding of theory. The practical informing the possible. That giving some form of life to the dead is even possible tells us something important about the nature of magic itself, about its origin, or perhaps about the way we use it. The Resurrectionist is alone in his ability for now, but why? Does he have access to a particular magic source or channel? Is his enhanced ability innate, instinctual, or is it learned? All of these answers, when found, will tell us something profound about magic.
Such as?
Well, if magical skill is innate, then we exist in a world where power truly is inherited. We can therefore begin to ask if the use of this power is genetic, and if so, does it follow certain bloodlines more closely than others? this kind of thinking, that there are certain superior bloodlines, has led humanity down dark paths more than once. But if the resurrectionist learned his ability, then we can assume that magic is a resource from which any person may draw, in which case we must know if it is a limited resource or if it renews itself. We might begin to allocate magical use to particular people in positions of prominence or influence. This would reinforce existing structures of power in our society. The wealthy and famous become the most magical, which brings further wealth and fame. If magic is an endless resource, however, there will be no inherent limit to its use. The human race will change on a fundamental level as we stop performing everyday tasks the old-fashioned way, so to speak.